You'd be hard pressed to find a better contender for the short list of most terrible Democrats than our very own Keith Ellison, congressman from Minnesota's 5th congressional district, representing Minneapolis, the most liberal congressional district in the state. Keith Ellison is one of those Democrats, Hillary Clinton-esque, if not worse, in the sense that he's so bad that you have to pause and actively recall the laundry list of ways in which this guy is so far outside of not just the mainstream, but like acceptable behavior, acceptable points of view in polite society. And yet he aspires to be the next attorney general of the state of Minnesota. We're going to talk about it here with the Republican endorsed candidate for that office, Doug Wardlow, on Closing Argument. My name's Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com and your iHeartRadio app. Two ways to stream us. We're here 9 to 11 weeknights. Appreciate you tuning in. You can catch up on past shows. Had a lot of good conversations with a lot of folks lately. You can catch all that by doing a search for Closing Argument in your iHeartRadio app, and our channel will pop right up. 651-989-5855 is the number to join us as we progress through the news this evening. Brad Ullman takes those calls and produces the show. We begin with Doug Wardlow, who is now the Republican-endorsed candidate for Attorney General here in the state of Minnesota. Welcome to the program, Doug.
Hi, Walter. Thanks for having me on.
It's a great pleasure. We had a lot of fun talking with you. Folks can look that up in their iHeartRadio app as well. The past interview we had with you before the convention, it was very informative, and it was great getting to know your views and getting to know you. Now we're talking under vastly different circumstances. What's your reaction? It's kind of a two-part question. What's your reaction to the chaos we've seen in the DFL over the past few days, and how specifically has the entry of Keith Ellison reshaped this race for Attorney General?
Right. Well, it's very interesting. You know, we've kind of got the DFL dumpster fire going on, with all the different candidate filings and people shuffling around. Lori Swanson jumping the governor's race, and then Keith Ellison jumping into the AG race along with others. But it's really an extreme team of hyper-partisan leftists that the Democrats have fielded for the Attorney General's race, and Ellison is just sort of leading the pack. But they're all very, very far left. You know, Deborah Hillstrom, Mike Rothman. These are out of touch. All these people are out of touch with Minnesotans.
There's a piece that I just found right before coming on the air in my inbox from Action for Liberty. They talk about the entry of Keith Ellison into the race. And this was really the spark that got me to make that claim that Ellison is one of those people that you got to pause and actually recall all the myriad of ways in which he's just not in sync with, you know, forget about our values as Republicans, just general American values.
Right.
They write, it's hard to imagine what could be worse for Minnesota than a radical socialist with former ties to the Nation of Islam becoming the top law enforcement officer in Minnesota. Lest we forget, that's what Attorney General is. Yesterday, Keith Ellison opted to not run again for Congress and threw his name in the hat for Attorney General in November. Now, there's a piece at MinnPost that I might get into later where they speculate, well, they don't speculate, they interview Ellison, and his articulated reason for, because this is quite remarkable, to step down from Congress and to step down from the prominent national position he has in the DNC in order to be a state attorney general could be characterized as a lateral move or worse. But the reason he wants to do so, according to his own mouth, is because he wants to fight Donald Trump.
That's right. You're right. It's really remarkable. So first of all, you've got a guy that worked for the Nation of Islam for 18 months. You know, he dined with Louis Farrakhan as recently as 2013 when Iran's President Rouhani was visiting the United States to address the United Nations. This guy has terrible associations with terrible people. He's an anti-Semite, right? He's a socialist. He's so far left. You know, it's unbelievable. And now he's specifically running for Attorney General just to obstruct the president's agenda.
And that, and explicitly saying it. Explicitly saying that that's his reason for doing it.
Right. So he just wants to politicize the office further, right? He just wants to take the AG's office and use it for entirely political purposes, which I guess is sort of carrying on the tradition that Lori Swanson and Mike Hatch and the Democrats have been carrying about along for 48 years of just politicizing the office, but he's going to take it to a whole new level.
Yeah, let's talk about that just for a second. We'll come back to Ellison. Lori Swanson, you know, bowing out of the contention for endorsement after the first ballot when she was ahead. This is just bizarre. And then deciding that she's going to run for governor, it kind of, to my mind, confirms what we talked about the last time we had you on the program, which is that Democrats just view this office of attorney general as a launching platform for being governor. And that's, she was going to have that, that she was going to go for that brass ring, you know, hook or crook.
Yeah, that's right. It just seems to be a political stepping stone for them. And you know, she lost the faith of her party. She pulled out of the endorsement. She must have seen that she was going to lose the endorsement after she didn't win on the first ballot. And then she pulled out, and the Democrats took a sharp left turn and endorsed Matt Pelican, who's got just a few years of experience as a lawyer and is even further to the left than Lori Swanson. But then she's jumped into the governor's race. It doesn't make a lot of sense. Except it does demonstrate that the Democrats see the Attorney General's office as nothing more than a political stepping stone and not the law enforcement office that it is.
Yeah, and that's exactly what Ellison intends to use it for. This from MenPost. After he filed his paperwork to run for Attorney General at the state capitol on Tuesday, Ellison spoke with MenPost and outlined his vision for the Attorney General job. He called it a people's lawyer who holds people in power accountable to make sure the average person has a fair shot. Now, that's you could take that and say, oh, that's neutral, nice-sounding language, but then he gets into the specifics. He says, as Attorney General, you get to enforce the law, and you get to make sure the powerful follow the rules. There's some things a member of Congress can't do. You cannot take immediate action to protect rights of people. A member of Congress can introduce legislation, try to make the law better, but an Attorney General can very pragmatically sue to make sure people's credit card companies are not taking advantage of them. This doesn't sound like a new use of the office from Democrats to me. This sounds like more of the same.
Yeah, it is more of the same. I mean, it is important to enforce our consumer fraud laws, but the Democrats do that to the exclusion of everything else. You know,
that's right.
Gutted the criminal law division of the office, leaving our county attorneys without the resources they need to prosecute criminals and, you know, put criminals behind bars. They focus on just the consumer fraud piece and then whatever they can do to block the president's agenda. You know, Lori Swanson sued the president a number of times already to block the travel ban. She also sued the president more recently to prevent him from putting a question on the census that asks about citizenship. So it's just going to be more of the same, more politicization of the office. Well, we apparently, Ellison intends to ignore all the very important duties of the office as in a law enforcement office.
We're talking with Doug Wardlow, the Republican-endorsed candidate for Attorney General here in the state of Minnesota. You can learn more about his campaign at DougWardlowAG.com. A couple of ways in that we know, without any doubt, that Keith Ellison will not enforce the law as he pretends to be aspiring to do. One is in immigration. Now, regardless of where you think the immigration law ought to be, currently we have a law that's on the books. And again, referencing this email here from Action for Liberty, if you want the Attorney General enforcing our immigration laws, you can bet money that Ellison won't do it. On May Day this year, Ellison marched in a parade wearing a shirt that called for the elimination of our nation's borders. I remember that because we talked about that here on the program.
It's preposterous. I mean, he doesn't believe in borders. He wants anarchy at the borders. We just can't trust him as our top law enforcement official in the state.
And another area in which he absolutely will not enforce the laws when it comes to the anarchy in the streets of Antifa, again from Action for Liberty. Ellison also made news recently for tweeting out a picture with a manual for the law-breaking group Antifa. Minnesota has had its issues already with prosecuting lawbreakers disguised as protesters. One could only imagine what radical, violent leftist groups will get away with under Ellison's tenure. And they got the picture here of Ellison with a smile in front of the Antifa, anti-fascist handbook, which, of course, is red, which is totally appropriate, right?
Right. I mean, he's just going to look the other way, right? He's just going to look the other way when they're up to their nonsense. And we can't have that. So he's against law and order. He's against the rule of law. He just wants to take that office to do political things, block the president's agenda, and then probably he's looking at higher office after that.
Yeah, it sounds like that's exactly the playbook here. So, you know, going forward, you are, I believe, unopposed in the primary. Is that correct?
Got a couple opponents, but no serious opposition that we can.
Okay. Yeah, the fact that I had to ask the question indicates how serious the opponents are.
Right, exactly. Right.
And the presumption is, well, do you have a presumption in terms of whether or not Ellison is going to survive his primary? Because he's got quite a few people, it looks like, that
well,
are
I don't fine. Know. I mean, he's got some competition on his hands, but he's got a pretty strong national following and probably right. a considerable war chest. So I think that he has a good shot at prevailing. Now, that being said, you know, he's just one of four Democrat candidates. All of them are extreme leftists, and
sure.
all of them will continue the politicization of the office and use it for the improper purposes. None of them are going to reinvigorate the criminal law division or do any of the things that we've talked about, crack down on child care and welfare fraud, lift the burden of regulations off of businesses. They're not going to do that.
Yeah, one of the things I noticed in the reporting from the Star Tribune on Lori Swanson's failure to secure endorsement on the first ballot is one of the reasons why the guy who did secure that endorsement, how do you pronounce his name? Pelican?
Yeah, I believe so.
Pelican. This guy, part of his case for why he should be the endorsed candidate for Attorney General over Lori Swanson was, quote, a progressive leader does not have an A-plus rating from the NRA. Now, So what the Democrats are basically telling us right now is that if you own a gun and if you care about securing your rights to continue owning it and using it in a law-abiding, rights-respecting manner, there's no place for you in the Democratic Party.
That's exactly what he's saying, and that's what the Democrats are saying. He's going to come after people's guns. He's not going to support our Second Amendment rights as Attorney General.
Yeah, and apparently Lori Swanson was too far to the right on the Second Amendment for the status quo of the DFL, which really calls into question the events of the past few days. You know, people were talking about Make Minnesota Red going into the convention weekend, and you know, you expect that from partisan rhetoric, but
right.
it's looking genuinely possible right now.
Things are looking very good. Things are looking up. You know, I think what it really comes down to is the Democrats have embraced this, you know, identity politics and celebrity politics to such an extent that they have lost their own identity as a party, and they really don't have anything of substance to offer. They're just grasping for power and trying to promote themselves in any way they can. That's why you see this dumpster fire of candidates jumping into these different offices and playing musical chairs, trying to, you know, angle for the best possible chance to propel themselves and get that power to do the things that they want to do and push things to the left in this state. So, but they don't have anything of substance really to offer.
Doug Wardlow, Republican-endorsed candidate for Attorney General. Again, you can find out more about his campaign at DougWardlowAG.com. Thanks for joining us on Closing Argument tonight.
Thank you so much, Walter.
Appreciate having you. 651-989-5855 is the number to join us. My name's Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com.
Can't explain all the feelings that you're making me feel.
It really was Christmas morning yesterday. All of the chaos on the Democratic side when it comes to filing for the various offices statewide. And, you know, frankly, the congressional districts as well. We had Kip and Max from Kip and Max Save the World on last night, and they were talking about the fact that 11 people had filed for Keith Ellison's vacated congressional seat. And I think that number has changed over the past 24 hours. That's the thing, is you can't even quote a number because it's probably changed between the time that you just Googled it and when you're saying it. That's how fast things have been moving here with this electoral chaos that we're experiencing right now in Minnesota, and it's a wrapped Christmas present for the Republican Party. And I don't know that anybody, I was about to say that I don't know that anybody's has more to gain from the past 4 days than Doug Wardlow, Republican endorsed candidate for Attorney General, because the potential of facing off against Keith Ellison truly does make that a horse race, in my opinion. Now, there's some analysis. You know, some people will say, yeah, but don't underestimate Keith Ellison. He's a really good campaigner and he turns out that vote. And that's true in his district. It's true in the urban core, in the cities. But what's not accounted for in his electoral success in the cities is the effect that he is going to have as a statewide candidate on the outstate voters who are going to come out and be mobilized simply to vote against him. I will be, I don't think it'll be hard to find voters who will be citing the candidacy of Keith Ellison as one of their primary motivators for coming out to vote in November, provided he makes it through the primary.
Yeah, part of the reason why the Democrats have controlled the Attorney General office for so long is because Republicans haven't been motivated to care about the office.
That's right.
And
Ellison just provided that motivation.
Yeah, and all things being equal, like Democrats just living in the city, being more connected, and kind of being closer to the movers and shakers in the political world,
right,
are going to be the ones who care about it and control the race. But now that Keith Ellison is running, it's going to be a completely different ballgame.
Well, and the success, what Ellison is known for and what Ellison is credited with properly, because, you know, legitimately, he can take credit for this, is turning out the vote, you know, working really hard when it doesn't benefit him directly, but working really hard to turn out the vote generally for Democrats in the cities in order to give the DFL the advantage they've enjoyed for quite a long time statewide. It's a huge part of the reason why Republicans have had such difficulty, basically been shut out from the statewide races ever since Tim Pawlenty was the governor. And the reason why that works, though, is because it's a strategy that is divorced from the personality of Keith Ellison. You know, it's easy for Ellison to get people to turn out in Minneapolis, and when there's no connection between him and his personality and the things that he has said and that he stands for to draw any sort of reaction from outstate, because he's not the face of the campaign. Making him the face of the campaign is going to incite reaction from voters outside the metro area, and they're going to come out just to vote against him. And that's going to counter the advantage that he has had in the past and that he has given the party in the past. This changes the landscape for the entire Republican Party this year.
Well, we've been talking more about Keith Ellison than we have about Aaron Murphy.
That's right. Now, we are going to talk about Aaron Murphy tonight. You know, in the 10 o'clock hour, I want to spend our first segment together in detail going through who Aaron Murphy is and what she believes, because honestly, I had no idea. I had to Google her. I had heard her name, but I didn't know anything about her. So we're going to try to introduce you to the DFL's endorsed candidate for governor at 10 o'clock. But you're right, Brad. Absolutely. There's more interest and focus on, which there's got to be a fair number of people. And I know they're probably not likely, because the Democrats have more discipline in this regard than we do here on the right. But there's got to be a lot of people in the Democratic Party who are really mad right now at this choice.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's so much infighting. It's like trying to pick your favorite music. Everyone has a personal taste, and so nobody's going to agree. And with 11 candidates running for CD5, the upheaval in at the caucus with Walls and, was it Rebecca Otto coming in hand
right.
in hand?
Yeah.
And just even if Democrats are debating if they should even have a caucus, if they need to change the day of the caucus.
Right.
You know, which candidate is running for what seat. I don't doubt that it's going to result in some victory that they're going to celebrate and trounce, but it's going to be almost like, it's almost like a blitzkrieg of Democratic candidates, in that they're going to overextend themselves. So they're going to run out of supplies along the way.
Right. Oh yeah, absolutely.
And Republicans are going to find ways to come behind and sweep up the mess that they've left.
Maybe. Because if there's anybody who knows how to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory, it's a Republican.
In Minnesota.
Especially a Republican in Minnesota. Absolutely. So, you know, as Kip and Max were saying last night at the end of the show, you know, if these contests and this election is something that you care about, you can't afford to rest on your laurels and just assume that the DFL is going to continue to implode. There will likely come a point at which something resembling unity on the Democratic side will emerge. And once that happens, you can expect them to march in lockstep, as they so often do in their collectivist fashion. And so, you know, the advantage needs to be taken now and needs to be seized now to put forth a provocative message, which has to be, by the way, has to be more than just look at how bad the Democrats are. look at how chaotic it is over there. Because that messaging, it might work right now to some degree, but it's dependent upon things continuing to be chaotic. And if things smooth out, if candidates drop out, if the message starts to unify, then you're not going to be able to rely upon criticizing the Democrats for their lack of organization anymore. You're actually going to have a value proposition for why you should be elected.
Well, I mean, if the Democrats do end up putting Ellison and Aaron Murphy on the ticket come November, it's going to be very easy to find reasons to vote against that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And that is the dream ticket for the Republicans to be running against. Although, as some people have been quite right to remind us, there were similar thoughts a few years back about Mark Dayton. When Mark Dayton prevailed over the DFL-endorsed candidate for governor, there were a lot of us, myself included, who thought, this is awesome. This is great. This is fantastic. There's no way. I believe it was 2010. Tom Emmer was the candidate. There's no way Tom Emmer's going to lose to Mark Dayton. I mean, look at the guy, right? Like, you could tell just by looking at him that he's off his rocker. He's a little bit nuts. He can't talk. He can't understand what he's saying. He's got crazy ideas. He probably is actually crazy. Of course we're going to beat this guy. And that presumption, of naturally, as we all know, failed to pan out. So, again, nothing should be taken for granted. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, 651-989-5855. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. One thing that this audience understands is that most of the problems that government attempts to solve were actually created by government. You know, it's kind of like pushing toothpaste around in a tube where, you know, government does one thing thinking that it's solving a problem, and it just pushes the consequences or the effects or the interests in a different direction and creates a new problem somewhere else. And then it's, oh, no, we got to intervene over here, too. And now we got to intervene over here, and now we got to intervene over here. And that's how the state grows, is through the perpetual putting out of fires started by the arsonist who claims to be putting them out, known as government. And I have a personal experience I want to share with you that I've been going through over the past month that has led me to yet another enlightening example of exactly how this works. And I imagine you may find it to be a little bit surprising. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. You can catch us streaming at TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com and on your iHeartRadio app. We're here 9 to 11 weeknights. Appreciate you tuning in. 651-989-5855 is the number to join us. Brad Omland takes those calls and produces the show. So I have been on a diet for the past month. And not just any diet, and not just for any reason. It's not because I'm, you know, look at myself in the mirror and think, oh, I'm sad, I need to go on a diet now. I have legitimate medical concerns. You know, I have been overweight since adolescence to varying degrees throughout my adult life. And it came to a head a few years back when I was diagnosed with type 2 diabetes. And I started having tangential difficulties associated with that. And it became very clear that I was at a crossroads. Either way, one way or the other, serious, consequential, monumental, life-shaping change was going to take place. And it was going to take place in one direction that was life-affirming, or another direction which was life-destructive. And so I made the choice to pursue aggressive weight loss through surgery. And that was about 3 years ago, three, 4 years ago now. And as is common with people who go through bariatric surgery, you lose a lot of weight right away, and you continue to lose weight for quite some time, but eventually you bottom out, and there's almost always a bounce. And some folks, unfortunately, can end up going right back to where they started. They can end up, you know, worse off than when they started. And because ultimately a surgery isn't going, there is no surgery for your willpower, right? Like there's no surgery for your discipline. There's no surgery for the personal decisions that you make on a day-to-day basis. Ultimately, it does come down to you as a human being, and you have to decide to adopt a different lifestyle. And the process of preparing for and going through the surgery and then recovering from it is an aggressive means of basically training your mind and body to engage in those healthy decisions when it comes to food. Now, there was some backsliding on my part, I hate to admit. And about a month ago, I decided, all right, that's enough. There's no way I'm going to be one of these people who has the surgery and then, you know, gains all the weight back. And so I started looking at things to do, and I started with what I had been doing immediately after the surgery and immediately after I recovered the ability to eat real food. And that was primarily eating meat and vegetables, and which sounds an awful lot like Atkins. I remember hearing about this thing called Atkins. And so I went back and I started Googling Atkins, and I tripped upon this thing called a ketogenic diet. And the ketogenic diet is a more extreme version of Atkins, where it's very high fat. It's about 70%. Well, there's different people do it in different ratios, but it's about 70% fat, 25% protein, and 5% carbs. You cut your carbs down to almost nothing. And the idea is that your body starts, when your body can't go to carbs, sugars, in order to fuel itself, the only other place it can turn is fat. And it starts learning how to burn dietary fat and eventually learning how to burn your body fat. And you can, you know, look at YouTube videos and go to various websites and read a bunch of books with people's results in engaging in this exercise known as the ketogenic diet. And the results are pretty dramatic. And, you know, I myself, it's been a month now, and I've lost 20 pounds.
Wow. Good for you.
Which, you know, granted, most of that is water weight, and it's the cleansing, it's the getting the garbage out of your system and all that jazz. The rate of weight loss will slow, but it's working. And part of the process, because I'm not the type of person, I'm not interested in jumping on fads. You know, if I'm going to do something, I want it to be well-researched and have some sort of rational scientific justification behind it. So I've been doing a lot of research into not just the ketogenic diet, but nutrition generally and how nutrition works. And imagine this, surprise, surprise, as I'm learning about nutrition and why it is that we eat the way we do and why it is that the food industry is crafted in the way it is, I discover, and you know, a lot of this I knew, but I had never focused on it to the extent that this journey has caused me to focus on it. The government has played a significant role in effectively poisoning us, and effectively poisoning us with sugar. And, you know, one of the things that we kind of take for granted in this country is the prevalence of carbohydrates on our plate. You know, the bread, the cakes, the cookies, the, you know, French fries. Once you're looking for carbohydrates like I am, and like anybody who's on Atkins or on a ketogenic diet is, you know, and you go through the store, it's amazing how much of the food that's available for our consumption is packed full of sugar, packed full of carbohydrates, high calorie, low nutrient. Now, as I say all this, you might be thinking to yourself, geez, Walter, you're starting to sound like a hippie. What is this? What's this hippie talk about nutrients and sugar and calories and how horrible the food industry is and what have you? Well, look, there are hippies who are into this, and they have some pretty ridiculous ideas, you know, because like all things, you can take a kernel of truth and spin it in whatever direction you want to take. But when you realize that the reason why our diet is the way it is because of the interference of the state, it puts a whole new spin on things. There's a paper by FEE, I think it's the Foundation for Economic Education. And the name of the paper is A Brief History of Food, Nutrition, and Government. And this is what they have to say about a key turning point in how our nation, how our federal government approached the concept of nutrition. In 1955, President Dwight Eisenhower suffered a heart attack. He was then treated by a renowned physician by the name of Dr. Paul Dudley White. Dr. White introduced the president to the nutritional ideas of a man named Ansel Keys. Now, local angle on this, Ansel Keys was out at the University of Minnesota. Eisenhower took to Ansel's ideas and instructed Dr. White to publicly announce Eisenhower's support for Keys and his diet recommendations. Following these events, President Eisenhower suffered from one stroke, Crohn's disease, and six more heart attacks until his eventual death in 1969 due to congestive heart failure. So, you know, apparently he wasn't finding much restoration in the advice of Ansel Keys. Keys had risen to influence in the highest levels of American government with his nutritional theory. Keys followed two main lines of thought, the diet-heart hypothesis and the lipid hypothesis. These theories collectively state that blood cholesterol causes heart disease and that saturated fat raises blood cholesterol. This theory dominated the American and much of the world's approach to nutrition and public policy for a long time. Keys' rise is impressive enough on its own, but is made even more so by the fact that he had no real evidence to support his ideas. And mention of this guy, Ansel Keys, has turned up time and time again in my research of nutrition. This was the modern day climate change movement in a previous life, in a prior life. The nutrition, the seizure of nutrition and the food industry by government was a precursor to what they're doing today with energy and taxation in the name of saving the earth from carbon gas. Because there was indeed no evidence whatsoever to support Ansel's claims, Keyes' claims, that basically fat was the enemy. You know, that's why, you know, as long as many of us have been alive, you go down the aisle in the store, everything's low fat this, low fat that, make sure you're not eating too much fat, right? Saturated fat, really bad for you. We used to hear, I used to hear it all the time when I was a kid. Now I'm reading that it's good for you. And we're used to this, right? We're used to getting one set of recommendations in one moment and a different set in another. And, you know, you're left scratching your head and thinking, well, if everything's bad to eat, then I guess I'm just going to do whatever because everything's bad to eat. Well, the truth of the matter is that depending upon who is telling you, they have a motive. They have a reason. And often it's economic. Often it's what they stand to profit from if their ideals or their concepts gain the traction of public policy. Once the state, once the government is on board with the idea that, oh yeah, we got to cut fat and we got to subsidize grain. We got to subsidize sugar. We got to subsidize soybeans, which is what the status quo is, right? All of this stuff on these shelves that we can buy so cheaply, it's all subsidized by the state. And it's simultaneously literally killing people.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost easier to find things without sugar than it is without soy. It's everywhere. Yeah. I mean, I don't eat a lot of junk food, but even like health, like foods that are supposed to be healthy for you, like soy as a male, and a male who's interested in fitness is bad for you.
Right.
It's not doing you any favors. So it's like you lose no matter what avenue you're trying to pursue. Like I try to cut soy out of my diet, but it's impossible.
Yeah. Well, there's stuff in everything. And even with what I'm doing, there are people out there who are purists in terms of, well, I only buy organic and I only buy grass fed and I'm not going to buy GMO and all this stuff. I don't have time for that. Like, I don't have the patience to be that discriminating. For me, I'm just going to look at the macronutrients, try to keep it in balance, watch the calories, and it's been effective thus far. But the point remains that the market for this stuff is not an actual market. It's not a market. And you know, I've watched a couple of documentaries. You can go on Netflix and watch this documentary called The Magic Pill that goes into detail about this. The market in a condition like, you know, pre-European Aborigines in Australia and what have you, they lived in a market system, right? In the truest sense of the word, because nobody's telling them what to do. And what was their diet like? It was meat. It was animal fats. It was plants, vegetables, and they were all fit. Fit and dying from old age and crocodile attacks. That's what was killing them. we can all get back to that if we start eating right. And the first essential step is to kick the government out of our dietary choices. Closing argument. My name is Walter Adson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. Whatever the legacy of President Donald Trump eventually ends up being, however history chooses to remember him, one contribution that he most assuredly will have made after he leaves is the insertion into the political lexicon of the term drain the swamp. That turn of phrase has taken root, has been adopted, and is used by a wide spectrum of people, many of whom are not necessarily talking about the same thing. And ever since this nomenclature first came onto the scene, drain the swamp, I've asked the same question about it that I asked about Barack Obama's hope and change back when he first ran, which is, what do you mean? What are you talking about? Because, you know, in order for draining the swamp to be a meaningful, worthwhile, desirable activity, you have to first define what the swamp is. And there's a group of people who have taken up that task and done so remarkably well. Closing argument. My name is Walter Adson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 1035 FM, 651-989-5855. Coming up on my Facebook news feed, I saw pop up this video of which we're about to play an excerpt. It's called The Swamp, and it's apparently a series. This was episode 3. I have not looked at the previous two, but you can bet I'll be following it from here on out, and I will go back to check those. It features a number of Washington lawmakers who confess in explicit terms what it's like to be a congressman, what it's like to be a senator, and the what the swamp is, what characterizes it, the pressures that they're under. And basically, you know, in case you don't know, basically what a congressman's job is, it's not to represent you, lest you believe that that's what it is. What a congressman's job is to raise money for the Republican Party. And it's so ingrained into the job description that they actually have to do it in order to have access to the means to represent their constituents. We got Tom Massey here, a clip.
I had a lobbyist in the medical device industry, and he said, Thomas, you're different from these other congressmen. You're smart. You know what you're doing. You understand technology. You're wasting your time on those B and C committees. You need to be on an A committee. In fact, you need to be on the Ways and Means Committee. And my lobbyist friends and I are prepared to raise the amount of money it's going to take to get you on the Ways and Means Committee. I wanted to run out of there. I mean, and when I did get out of the basement of the Capitol Hill Club after his proposal, I was trying to find a shower. I had to get the scum off. Just being part of that conversation felt dirty.
My assessment is $300,000. That's what I'm supposed to pay to rent my position on these three committees. And no, your assessment is subject to change based on leadership roles. In other words, if you get more power here, they're going to charge you more. And if you can't pay today, just sign this piece of paper pledging that you will make this payment in full before the due date. In fact, they'll fold this sucker up and stick it in your pocket on the floor of the House at votes, just to remind you that you owe some money if you want to keep your committee assignment. Now, renting committee assignments and chairmanships, it should be illegal. If you did this sort of thing in a city council meeting or a state legislature, they would perp walk you in handcuffs in front of the evening news. But it's legal here, because who's going to make a law stopping us? Even the Constitution says that the House and the Senate shall make their own rules. Over the years, I suppose my bill is about $1.2 million. I paid $6,000. That was the first month that I was here. I didn't know any better. Ostensibly, the money goes for a good cause. Look, it's to keep us in the majority. And the Democrats do the same thing. It's to take back the majority. The problem is the incentive structure is set up to get you to sell out to lobbyists because they're the only ones who have the currency you need, which is campaign dollars, to buy your committee assignment. It's a terrible choice. Why should you have to do this? You're faced with coming up here and prostituting yourself just so that you can get a committee assignment where you can represent your constituents the best.
So here's my question for President Donald Trump. You campaigned on draining the swamp. You made it the central premise of your candidacy for president. Where are you on this? Where's your leadership? Why aren't you tweeting this video out? Why aren't you tweeting about how this is how corrupt the status quo in the Congress is? Why aren't you using your platform to affect real change, meaningful, systemic change, which will actually reform the way business is done in Washington, D.C.? I think we deserve an answer to that question. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, 651-989-5855, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 1035 FM. We're streaming on TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com and on your iHeartRadio app. You can catch us 9 to 11 weeknights. It's great having you with us. 651-989-5855, the number to join us. Brad Omland takes those calls and produces the show. Let's go to such a call. Let's talk to Alex in Minneapolis. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, sir. Good to listen. I just kind of stumbled on here. I've been into listening to a lot of conservative talk radio lately, and I just found your station, and I enjoy what I'm hearing so far.
Well, welcome.
But I wanted to touch on this ketogenic diet you're talking about.
Sure. Go ahead.
I have been doing this for... let me see. I got to guess.
Months, years, weeks? 20 years. Wow.
I think so, off and on.
Okay.
When I first did it, I had the success that you're talking about. I went from, 250, 260 down to 210, 215. It mm-hmm. worked great.
Sure.
Unfortunately, when you go off it, it doesn't.
Yeah, right.
And you gain it all back.
Right.
And the older I've been getting, the less success I've been having on it.
Sure.
My problem seems to be that I eat too much protein. Uh-huh.
Oh, yeah. I've heard that can be an impediment. Absolutely. Yeah.
I don't know where to get the fat from.
Well, what I've been doing is I've been eating a lot of eggs, which I never used to be we never even bought eggs really in our house, but I've just been going through them like crazy. Tons and tons of eggs. I hard boil them and then take them with me to my day job and, have a snack on them throughout the day. Lots of string cheese and, sticks of pepper jack cheese and what have you. And, I get beef jerky sometimes, although that's got some carbohydrates in it, but more of like beef sticks that you can find at the grocery store, which has protein in it, but it also has fat. So that's kind of been how I've been doing it. And then for my meals, like when I'm on the go, I'll stop and get a salad, and that seems to balance it out. Now I haven't been doing the strict 5% carbs, and there's different ways that you can measure it. They use this concept called net carbs, which I'm sure you're familiar with, where you subtract the amount of fiber in a food product from the amount of carbs, and then you have your net carbs. And so you can count them that way. And some people, a friend of mine who's doing this, said that he doesn't count any of the carbohydrates that he gets from vegetables. And, so I don't know what the wisdom of that is or if that's somehow cheating. But, my carbs end up being about 15% of what I'm eating. And it's working anyway. So, the way I look at it, the ketogenic aspect of trying to have fewer carbs so that you can have more fat and therefore train your body to burn fat, that's a nice bonus as I look at it. But to my mind, as long as I'm watching my calories, I'm going to lose weight, right? I mean, it's ultimately energy in, energy out. Appreciate
it. Makes sense. Makes sense.
Appreciate the call, Alex. Appreciate you listening to the program. All right. So I want to get into talking about Aaron Murphy, who is the endorsed candidate on the Democratic side for governor. And like I say, that I had heard the name in passing, but I had to Google her. I had to research her. There wasn't a whole lot that I knew about this gal other than the fact that she existed and was a Democrat prior to her being endorsed by her party to be the next governor of the state of Minnesota. And so the first place that I turned to was an editorial from the Pioneer Press, and this was from back in November, long before she secured the party's endorsement. And they sat down with her, and this is how they describe her. An urban Democrat in a state with an apparently deep divide that pits the metro area against greater Minnesota to no one's benefit. The six-term House member from St. Paul and candidate for governor described efforts to build to bridge it, or that gap between metro and outstate, in a recent meeting with the editorial board. She talks about traveling with or traveling our big, tall state and connecting with voters in coffee shops, living rooms, and farm fields as she works to deepen connections with a diverse array of Minnesotans. Her conversation with the Pioneer Press editorial board, is among a series of meetings with those on a long list of declared candidates for governor from both parties. At this point, just short of a year until Election Day, our focus is on policy rather than personality. In her travels, Murphy, who highlights her small-town upbringing in Wisconsin, has found what she describes as deep-seated hopefulness in Minnesotans, despite a divisive political climate. So this is the point that I want to focus on here out of the gate, is the divisiveness. That's the theme that's set by the Pioneer Press editorial board here, is that we live in divisive times, we're a divided state, a divided country, and the orientation of Aaron Murphy is to try to bridge that divide, to try to unify us and bring us together. Here's the key paragraph. Divisions, she told us at the Pioneer Press, are evident in, quote, competition for resources rather than cooperation. And a general feeling that my community is being left behind somehow. Now, this is fascinating language to me because on its face, she's right. On its face, if you just take the words, absent any context, absent what she means by those words, and you just judge them on their face, on their merit, she's correct. Division is evident in competition for resources rather than cooperation. But here's the thing. Aaron Murphy and the rest of the Democrats, the rest of the political left, have no idea what that means. She has no idea what she's talking about and, tangentially, what is required in order to fix it.
Well, she has no idea of the consequences.
She cannot, and the Democrats cannot, solve the things that divide us. Because what divides us is force. What divides us is the lack of freedom of association. The fact that we have all been thrown into the same pot together. And have to come up with a one-size-fits-all solution that for those of us who disagree with it are going to have to go along with anyway. You know, when she talks about competition as opposed to cooperation, there is only one context in which cooperation is possible, and that's liberty. Just think about what the lack of liberty is, what force is. Obviously, you can't cooperate under coercion, right? Like, that's an oxymoron. There's no such thing as coerced cooperation. And yet, here's Aaron Murphy, in typical Democratic fashion, wringing her hands over how divided we are and how we all need to cooperate better, in a context where she's vying for a job where her prescriptions for public policy are nothing but one prospect of coercion after another. She wants to force us to do things her way. She wants to force us to make the decisions she would make. She wants to force us to do what she wants us to do, to not do what she doesn't want us to do. And this is evident as she goes forward with the various things that she talks about and that she's running for. Continuing at the Pioneer Press, Murphy supports a single-payer healthcare system, providing government-paid or universal care for all, describing it as the end goal of reform that puts patients first. She suggests that Minnesota can lead the way by opening up MinnesotaCare, the state's subsidized insurance program for the working poor, to everyone. Now, you know, setting aside how she could possibly pay for that, how we could possibly afford that as a state, having MinnesotaCare for every man, woman, and child in Minnesota, how is this fostering cooperation? Again, you're putting a gun to my head. You know, look at Obamacare. Look at the AHA or the ACA. You're putting a gun to my head and telling me what I have to buy, the terms on which I have to buy it, how much I can pay for it, what doctor I can see, what I can even get treated for, right? Like the extreme version of this is what we just saw in the United Kingdom over there in Britain with the one, if not two babies who were forced to die against their parents' wishes, in spite of their parents' resources and desire to pursue alternative therapies and alternative care. That's what the prescription is here. That doesn't sound like cooperation to me. You know, those parents weren't being cooperated with by their community, by their state. And yet that's what Erin Murphy stands for. Continuing at the Pioneer Press, she also emphasizes putting Minnesotans and their healthcare providers, quote, back in control of their care to better manage costs and improve outcomes. Well, that's not going to happen because you're never going to be in control of something that you don't pay for. These two ideas don't jive. It's a cognitive dissonance. You can't on the one hand say, well, we want to make sure that everybody gets a thing, but we also want them to have control over it. That doesn't work. The only way you're going to have control over your healthcare is if you are the one who is paying for it, because that is what gives you the moral authority over it. He who has the gold makes the rules, right? Murphy, continuing again at the Pioneer Press, a former majority leader in the Minnesota House of Representatives, is among both Democrats and Republicans talking about transparency at the Capitol. Rather than the now common practice of deal-making behind closed doors, Murphy wants to see negotiations return to committees where proceedings will be open to the scrutiny of the public and other lawmakers. In addition, bills that reach her desk as governor won't get Murphy's signature, she told us, if they were delivered to lawmakers at the last minute without time for a review. Now, on this last point, she actually has common ground with the likes of Jeff Johnson. You know, I heard my legislator, my state representative, Eric Lucero, came before our city council on Monday and basically outlined this same desire to see mechanisms put in place to ensure that bills are dutifully considered. So I'm glad to hear that we can find some bipartisan agreement on some process reforms that are definitely needed. There's a whole list of things we can go through here off of Erin Murphy's website. There's an On the Issues page about Erin Murphy, and we will, as we move forward here in this election season, heading towards the primary and towards the general election, if she prevails to be the Democrats' candidate moving forward, we're going to continue to expose who Erin Murphy is. And, you know, here it is in a nutshell. She wants to put a gun to your head. Like any Democrat, they want to put a gun to your head and tell you what to do. That they are effectively no different than a common bank robber. I mean, literally, they want to take your money, right? You know that. They want to take your money, but they're worse than a bank robber. Because at least the bank robber, first of all, he doesn't come in and try to convince you that he's doing you a favor, right? Like, he doesn't walk into the bank and be like, by giving me this money, you're actually making yourself better off. Give me this money for your children, right? Like, the robber is honest enough to tell you that he's robbing you. He comes in and he says, stick him up, right? Plus, the other way in which a robber is better than a Democrat, a bank robber, is that after he's done taking your money, he's gone. He leaves your life. You don't have to deal with him anymore. He doesn't stick around to tell you what to do. 651-989-5855. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, twincitiesnewstalk.com. There's been some interesting rulings coming out of federal courts lately. We're going to get into here later on the Supreme Court ruling in the gay cake case. I don't know exactly how to refer to this. It's not, the cake isn't gay, but you know what I'm talking about. Gay marriage, baking cakes for...
Cake is pretty gay.
Yes, the keto people would agree with you that that cake is pretty gay. But yeah, there's been some interesting judgments. We're going to talk about a lesser one here before we dive next segment into the Supreme Court decision on religious liberty. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, 651-989-5855 if you want to join the program. Always an option. We're very welcoming, tolerant, and inclusive here on the program of various ideas and commentary. So by all means, join us. Jump in the fray. From the Star Tribune, a federal court has ruled that printing "In God We Trust" on U.S. currency doesn't amount to a religious endorsement and therefore doesn't violate the United States Constitution. The Chicago Daily Law Bulletin reports the 7th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in Chicago made the ruling Thursday in a lawsuit brought by a self-declared Satanist by the name of Kenneth Mayle. He argued that the motto propagates a religious view he opposes. A lower court tossed the suit, citing a Supreme Court decision that a motto on currency isn't something people display prominently, and thus that people are not forced to publicly advertise views that clash with their own. Now, that's an interesting argument. And to some degree, I agree with it. There's another aspect in which I don't. It occurs to me that there has to be some sort of inherent value in having "In God We Trust" on the currency. Otherwise, why is it there? Right? Like the whole point in putting it there in the first place is to express something, right? But the question becomes, who is doing the expression? Is it the guy who's bearing the currency? By virtue of the fact that you have a dollar bill and the dollar bill says "In God We Trust," does that make you part of the "we" because you're holding the dollar? That seems to me to be a specious argument. So in that sense, I think the court was absolutely right here. You know, the imagery or message beyond the denomination of the currency, 1, 5, 10, and so forth, doesn't necessarily reflect what the people physically holding the currency believe. The real problem here, though, which the court doesn't address, and of course they wouldn't address it because they'd be criticizing their own source of power, is the lack of freedom to compete with the Federal Reserve note. You know, if Satanists are really offended by "In God We Trust" on their dollars, then they shouldn't have to use dollars. They should be able to turn to an alternative form of currency that somehow expresses Satanism. I don't know. I don't know that there is.
Devil coin.
Yeah, devil coin. I don't know that there's an option along those lines, but I'm sure they could come up with one. And the market would price it appropriately, I'm sure.
Anyone can invent a cryptocurrency. It's not difficult. Well, it is difficult, but it's like it's not that difficult to have a coin because there are hundreds of them out there.
Sure, sure. From USA Today, the Hospital Trust Fund for Medicare, the federal health care program relied on by tens of millions of older Americans and many who are disabled, is expected to run out of money by 2026, 3 years earlier than expected. But everything's fine. Everything's fine. You know, Kim Kardashian visited the White House. We're talking about kneeling and national anthems again and what have you. Everything's fine. A new federal report by trustees of the giant fund also covers Social Security, which millions of older Americans depend on for income, just as it does many of the disabled. Trustees said the trust fund for the hospital's expenses is not sufficiently financed over the next decade. That's in part due to lower payroll taxes because of lower wages and lower Social Security benefit taxes, the trustees said. Spending was also projected to be somewhat higher than last year's estimates due to legislative changes that led to higher hospital and Medicare Advantage payments.
Nuh-uh, it's because millennials are lazy. They're so entitled. They think that they can just show up and go to work and somebody will take care of them in the future, but they need to work hard to support the entitlement programs that we've robbed them of.
You know, there was a piece, and I haven't read it, and it should be in the stack. Maybe we'll pull it for tomorrow. By Matt Walsh, where he's making exactly the case that you're sarcastically implying right now. He put out this article. The headline was something to the effect of, "Everybody gets on millennials for being entitled, spoiled brats,
but they were raised by entitled spoiled brats, the boomers, right? Like, it's absolutely true. And the point that Walsh revels in is how audacious it is for those parents to look at their children and say, you are such scumbags, when they learned it from watching you, Dad, right? Like, that's exactly, it's the behavior that they were raised to exhibit, or at least, you know, that they modeled in their own lives. And so what do you expect? Yeah, and the existence of these entitlement programs and the expectation, and we've heard it from callers into this program multiple times, the sense of entitlement and expectation that I will get what's mine, quote unquote, even though what's yours was already stolen from you years ago. What's yours is gone. And in order for you to get anything today means that somebody else has to have it taken from them.
They paid for the guarantee.
You know, it's you listen, the music stopped. And you don't got a chair. This was going to happen to somebody. This was going to happen to a generation, and it just might be yours.
Well, as we've seen with lots of government programs, there's no warning that they're out of money.
Right.
It's just, there's no money. Sorry, you're not getting that.
Yeah. Well, and that's how the precursor to austerity and all sorts of social unrest, which is what we're steering towards here. And it's going to be the fault of literally everyone. It's going to be the fault of every single person at every level, whether they're elected to office or not. You know, the few of us out here who are advocating for the type of change that is necessary is so negligible that you might as well just dismiss it and say it's everybody's fault. It's a product of our culture, a product of our society that we find ourselves in this mess. And we're at a point where even moderate reforms of the type that Paul Ryan was talking about a few years ago, you know, the idea that we're going to slowly wean working generations that are working now off of their expectation that they're going to get benefits in the future, even that would not be effective at this point, because we're talking about the thing being insolvent in 2026, less than 10 years from now. You're not going to be able to tell people. You would have to tell people who are, you know, I don't know what the Medicare age is. Let's assume it's 65.
62.
It's 62. Okay. So you would have to tell people who are 54 years old, oh, hey, by the way, we're reducing your expected payments. What do you think the political consequences of that would be? It would be hair on fire, you know, people getting ousted from office and what have you. So culturally, there has to be a sea change in how we think about providing for ourselves, how we think about our relationship to the state and to each other and to younger generations. There needs to be a reformation of individual responsibility and generational responsibility. Like, you know, look, one of the things that is frequently bemoaned, not so much anymore, because I don't even know if people have this expectation, but people used to have this expectation that elders would be respected in a society. That, you know, you call your, you know, when I was a kid, you went over to your friend's house and you talked to his dad. You didn't refer to him as John or whatever his name was. You referred to him as Mr. Smith, right? And it was yes, sir, no, sir. And this is in the 80s, okay? This isn't going back that far. You know, and so there's no expectation of that. There's no real respect shown to elders. And a lot of people, myself included, have bemoaned that. But here's the deal. You know why no respect is shown to elders? Because it ain't due. Because it hasn't been earned. Because it doesn't come automatically. Because your authority is established through service. And we have an entire generation of folks who have raised their children with the expectation that those children were going to pay for their retirement, pay for their health care, and pay for their way out the door. 651-989-5855. Closing argument. My name is Walter Adson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. When I first saw mention in my social media news feeds that a baker who had been sued by a gay couple when he refused to design a cake for their wedding ceremony had won a case brought to the Supreme Court, my spirits were lifted. I was genuinely surprised because this is out of character for the Supreme Court, even with the conservative majority that it currently enjoys. It's amazing how unconservative the Supreme Court is despite having a conservative majority, isn't it? I mean, lest we forget that it was the current Chief Justice, under the current Chief Justice, that the horrific and laughably just legally ridiculous ruling on Obamacare, upholding Obamacare, to rewriting the law, rewriting the legislation to turn a fee into a tax, when the White House under Obama had explicitly said it's a fee, is just absolutely astounding. You know, this is why the argument, going back to, you know, when we were in the 2016 election, the argument that, well, we have to vote for whoever the Republican is, no matter what, because of the Supreme Court. Really? What's the Supreme Court done lately that's been of much worth? You have to answer that question for me. At any rate, when I first saw the headline that this case had gone down the way it did, my spirits were lifted. The deeper I dug into it, however, the more concerned I became that this isn't really a victory. This is not a long-term, sustainable, momentous victory on behalf of religious liberty or any kind of liberty. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. You can catch us streaming at TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com and on your iHeartRadio app. We're here 9 to 11 weeknights. Catch up on past shows by doing a search for Closing Argument in your iHeartRadio app. 651-989-5855 is the number to join us. Brad Ullman takes those calls and produces the show. So here's the basic reporting on what took place from Reuters. The U.S. Supreme Court on Monday handed a victory on narrow grounds, and that's the key, narrow grounds, to a Colorado baker who refused, based on his Christian beliefs, to make a wedding cake for a gay couple, stopping short of setting a major precedent allowing people to claim religious exemptions from anti-discrimination laws. The justices, in a 7-2 decision, said the Colorado Civil Rights Commission showed an impermissible hostility toward religion when it found that Baker Jack Phillips violated the state's anti-discrimination law by rebuffing gay couple David Mullins and Charlie Craig in 2012. The state law bars businesses from refusing service based on race, sex, marital status, or sexual orientation. The court concluded that the commission violated Phillips' religious rights under the U.S. Constitution's First Amendment. But the justices did not issue a definitive ruling on the circumstances under which people can seek exemptions from anti-discrimination laws based on religion. The decision also did not address important claims raised in the case, including whether baking a cake is a kind of expressive act protected by the Constitution's free speech guarantee. Now, this is the third time that I've read this. The third time. And maybe I'm not smart enough to figure it out, but I don't understand how they made these rulings without settling those questions. Like, on what basis do you claim that Jack Phillips' First Amendment rights were violated by the Colorado Civil Rights Commission if it's not true that, like, you can't say his rights were violated without articulating how? I mean, I guess you can if you're the Supreme Court, because, you know, we're not actually talking about people who are trying to parse through the law and give some sort of definitive answer. We're just talking about a royal commission cloaked in power and black robes who could just say whatever they want. But I don't understand how they could say, well, you know, this guy's rights were violated, but we're not going to address how or come up with any sort of guideline or precedent explicitly declaring how his rights were violated in order to help anybody in the future avoid finding themselves in the same circumstance.
I mean, it's okay that we don't know, because it is, I mean, obviously, you know, like we've talked about before, you have a right to associate with people as you see fit, but it's...
Well, then why can't they say that?
Because it's not in the Constitution? Explicitly?
Then I don't... On what basis can you claim that his First Amendment right, which is in the Constitution explicitly, was violated if you're not going to address how?
Because it's not a First Amendment issue, actually.
But that's the basis of their ruling.
That's why they didn't rule on it.
Yeah, it drives me nuts. Here's what gets me. When it's a conservative issue and when a ruling teeters even remotely in the conservative direction, the Supreme Court is always extraordinarily precise and narrow and deliberate and cautious. And well, we don't want to step upon the legislative mission or mandate, even when they're not. That's, they wouldn't be doing that in this case. You know, we don't want to get ourselves involved in the politics of this. So we're just going to make this, you know, tiny, nice little surgical ruling that has no broader impact. But when the left comes along with their cases, it's, oh, we have gay marriage now.
Well,
we just have it. And it's been there all along. Didn't you know George Washington was for gay marriage? Like, if it's a lefty cause, if it's a progressive cause, even with a conservative majority, the Supreme Court will turn over the entire game table of society enthusiastically. But when it comes to something as simple as, hey, this is my shop and I get to, and, hey, more fundamentally, this is my life and I get to decide how I'm going to use my life and what relationships I'm going to enter into and on what terms, they can't affirm that simple, self-evident, fundamental moral truth. They're cowards. That's the only way I can see it.
I mean, I don't have a whole lot of formal legal training, but in what I do, I get the sense that it's not about telling someone no. It's about telling them, well, yes, but, and kind of giving them guidelines or restrictions, or better yet, finding a way to make it legal. It's not illegal. It's I will make it legal. And so in a ruling that they want to make legal, they will. They'll find a way to do it, as right. we saw with the Obamacare Obama. Ruling.
Yeah, right.
But if they just disagree with it, they'll be like, well, go back to the drawing board and we'll reevaluate later.
Yeah, I mean, all you need to know to indicate that this was not the monumental victory for conservatism that some people would like to portray it as, in Reuters, they report two of the court's four liberal justices, Stephen Bayer and Elena Kagan, joined the five conservative justices in the ruling authored by Justice Anthony Kennedy. If this ruling had any sort of substance to it, if it had any sort of meaningful impact upon jurisprudence moving forward, there's no way Elena Kagan, of all people, would be on board with it. This was basically them kicking this case down, kicking the can down the road, wiping this case off of, you know, their roster so that they don't have to deal with it anymore, and saying, we're not actually going to make all of the relevant decisions that this case raises. We're not going to address why this case came before us because we're lazy cowards. Closing argument. My name is Walter Edson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. Here's some more context to help us understand where the Supreme Court is coming from on this ruling, where they said that in this specific case of this specific Colorado baker, his First Amendment rights were violated by the Colorado Civil Rights Commission when they acted against him in response to a lawsuit brought by a gay couple that was seeking his services to design a cake for their wedding. From the Wall Street Journal, in the 7-2 ruling, the justices found that the Colorado Civil Rights Commission had failed to consider Mr. Phillips' religious objections with a neutrality demanded by the First Amendment. Justice Anthony Kennedy's majority opinion drew from transcripts of public hearings that he said showed some commissioners disparaging Mr. Phillips' faith. In a statement, the Colorado Civil Rights Division said the court has sent a message requiring that its deliberations remain objective. So the effect of this is, the real message, the only real effect of this ruling on anything moving forward, is that if you're bigoted against Christians, you better shut up about it when you're making your rulings on the Civil Rights Commission of your given state. You better conjure some objective-sounding reason why you're going to violate somebody's individual rights, encroach upon their property, encroach upon their very life, and tell them what relationships they can enter and on what terms. You better cloak it in something that sounds vaguely neutral when it comes to religion itself. That's the only effect of this SCOTUS ruling. Let's go to the phones. Let's talk to David in Woodbury. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you. It occurred to me that if I had a half pig, right, I went out to farm, farmer slaughtered a half pig, got a half pig out of the slaughter, right? And now I needed to get it butchered and packaged, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, if I brought it to a Hillel butcher or I brought it to a kosher butcher, they would refuse to do it, right?
Correct.
Because it directly violates their values and their religion.
Right.
So I guess my question or my point is, that is the type of thing that I think maybe we should start, hopefully the Supreme Court and stuff is going to start to look at, is do we really allow people to have true religious objections to doing things, or do we make them essentially slaves of the government and ignore the separation, if you will, of church and state?
Option B.
That's my comment.
Option B. I appreciate the comment, David. It's option B. That's why they won't make a definitive ruling in this case. They don't want that world. They don't want a world where there is objective, you know, it's funny, we're talking about objectivity by the Civil Rights Commission. They don't want the world where cases are judged on their merits. They don't want the world where people have the ability to determine based upon their own values what kind of relationships and transactions they enter into. They want a world where very particular people are discriminated against, those who are politically incorrect, while the rest of the approved, the rest of the knighted progressives get to do whatever they want, laying claim to your labor, your property, your business, if you dare disagree with them. Let's talk to Barry in St. Paul. Welcome to the program.
Hey, so it seems like your argument about all this, irregardless of what we're exactly talking about, the specific issue, is that you want to see judicial activism on the Republican side or the conservative side just as much as you see judicial activism on the Democratic side or the socialist side. That doesn't make a whole bunch of sense. The reason why these rulings are written the way they are is because when there's a majority opinion on the conservative side, the people who write it actually follow the idea of the Constitution like you'd like to see, and they don't want to be judicial activists. But when you see how
you have to answer this question for me. How is it judicial activism to say, hey, we've got this thing called the First Amendment, and it says you get to exercise your religion as you see fit, which implies logically that you get to determine whether or not an action you are being asked to take violates your conscience. How is that in any way controversial? How is that judicial activism? Isn't that just morally correct?
I don't disagree that it's morally correct, but to do what you're asking them to do in the case that they're seeing before them, it is not something that they could do.
How to judge the case in any way other than what I just articulated? How is that not rewriting the First Amendment itself? Why do we even have a First Amendment if it doesn't mean what it says? Why even have it if it doesn't mean that you can say what you want, worship how you want, conduct your life in a way that is consistent with your conscience and your values?
Because that's not what the First Amendment says. All it says is that you have a right to do what you believe is, right? Right?
Say that's what literally what I just said.
And that the government can't punish you for it.
But that's what's at stake here.
I understand, but when they made the decision, right, that this tribunal or this group of people that is government entity wasn't non-biased, that's what they're saying, is that we can't do that. The government can't do that. The people who brought the lawsuit against the people, they can say whatever they want to say and bring the lawsuit against them, and the people, and there should be a hearing about it, and there should have been a decision about it. And I don't disagree that it should have been.
Here's the inconsistency. This is what frustrates me, Barry. You can't tell me that this guy's First Amendment rights were violated by the commission saying nasty things about his religion. Like, he has a right to not be offended by the Colorado Civil Rights Commission, but he doesn't have a right to actually conduct his life according to his beliefs? This is absurd. I don't need the Supreme Court. Like, that's judicial activism. I don't need the Supreme Court to protect me from other people's opinions. I don't need them to protect me from, you know, the words that people throw at me. I need them to protect me from sticks and stones. I need them to protect me from the initiation of force, whether it comes from my neighbor or from the state. That's their job. That's why the Constitution was written. That's why we had an American Revolution in the first place. Closing argument. My name's Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com.